I'm a TDSB parent, and I'm here today representing independent Jewish voices. I am Jewish. I am anti-Zionist. I'm also an Israeli raised by diehard Zionist Israeli parents. I know the Zionist perspective. I was that perspective. And what I know about that perspective is that it is fundamentally rooted in fear. Fear of disappearing, fear of annihilation, fear of losing what Zionists believe is rightfully theirs. It's a fear so deeply rooted that it closes ranks, silences dissent, and views any challenge as an existential threat. And this fear has been weaponized to perfection by the Israeli lobby to gaslight not just Palestinians, but all of us over the past 76 years. You, dear trustees, are afraid to say any of this out loud. And I get it. Each of you joining us today is operating from a place of fear. And it's not just you, it's every elected official from City Hall to Parliament. You are afraid of the pro-Israel lobby. You are afraid of being branded anti-Semitic. You are afraid that the decisions you make today could cost you your careers. And again, I get it. The lobby has spent decades creating this gaslit environment where any criticism of Israel is equated with hatred of Jews, where even acknowledging Palestinian humanity can end careers. So while your fear no doubt feels real, I need you to know that it pales in comparison to the fear faced by your youngest constituents every single day, the Palestinian students who live in fear of being punished for simply existing. Imagine being a kid in school, navigating all the challenges of growing up, and then being told that your very identity, who you are as a person, is unwelcome or dangerous. So your job today is to grab that fear by the throat and remind yourself why you're here. You were elected to protect all students, not just some. Don't let fear dictate your decisions today. Don't let political pressure crush your integrity or your conscience. Be bold. Stand up for justice, for humanity, and most importantly, for every single last student who looks to you for protection. Free Palestine, free every square inch of Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea.
Greetings. My name is Jessa McLean. Welcome to Blueprints of Disruption, a podcast aimed at amplifying the work of the grassroots, sharing stories of resistance, and dismantling the status quo. Instead of our typical intro this week, you heard a delegation that was originally given to the Toronto District School Board here in Ontario. Not only does that clip help lay the groundwork for the next discussion with education workers, it does a great job of explaining how we got to this point. What point is that? Let's just say our public schools are not safe places for Palestinians or anyone expressing solidarity with Palestine. They're not safe places to call out the genocide or even the state of Israel. In a moment, you'll hear from educators themselves. You'll hear what they've learned from their own personal experiences with suppression, but also what they've learned from analyzing and amplifying the many delegations, like the one you just heard, that have been given to school boards across Ontario and surely across Canada. Evidence of anti-Palestinian racism, of erasure, isolation, silencing, discrimination, unfair reprisals, weaponized anti-Semitism, and more have been provided to school trustees over and over again. The vast majority of them refuse to act. Parent, teacher, and student activists have had to push them for every single inch. We previously had Toronto Palestinian families and Toronto Jewish families on to talk about their experience organizing and resisting within school communities. Now we're going to hear from education workers helping to further that work. Labor for Palestine, Ontario Education Workers United, compiled and issued a report in April 2025 titled School Delegations for Palestine. Their subtitle was taken from one of those delegations. It reads, "Mama, they simply cancel us. They don't care." We've called these folks into the studio to talk about that report, what they plan on doing with it, and why documenting all of these stories is so important to the fight for a free Palestine. Be sure to share the episode with a friend. You'll not just help boost the show, but also the work of these educators. There's also a ton of resources in the show notes, as always. The report we reference here, calls to action, ways to get in touch with us and our guests, and more on the topic at hand. That's it for housekeeping. Let's get to the discussion. Okay, welcome to Blueprints of Disruption. We have quite a few guests with us today. We're going to take a brief second and meet them before we really get into why they are here.
My name is Sheila. I come here as a teacher, a parent, and a Palestinian. My father was born in Haifa in 1935, and he lived there until 1948. When his land was stolen. So I am a daughter of a Nakba survivor.
I am Laura. I am an elementary school teacher, activist, a settler, colonizer on these lands, also an immigrant. And I'm happy to be here.
My name is Nigel Brief. I'm a school teacher by profession. Right now, I'm out of the classroom. I'm vice president at the Elementary Teachers of Toronto. I also do act as the anti-racism lead for the organization. My volunteer time is spent, I'm the chair of the Urban Alliance on Race Relations. 50 years we've been fighting for, and I also sit on the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, where we research about how what's happening with the far right here in Canada and internationally. And then my biggest, most favorite job is being a dad who gets to drive his son and his friend to soccer practice. So yeah, I really appreciate being here and thanks for having us all on.
Hi, thank you. My name is Michelle. I am a math educator in the Toronto District School Board, and I am a Jewish parent to two Jewish kids in the Toronto District School Board.
This is a section of Labor for Palestine, who we have had on the show a few times now. So the audience should be, I mean, the Labor for Palestine name sort of explains the premise of the organization. But Ontario Education Workers United, what was the impetus for starting that particular group?
I know that many of us came to the work of the Ontario Education Workers United through the, you know, what's happening in the public education system, what's happening in public services, period, in Ontario. We have one of the most right-wing, misogynistic governments that we've seen in my lifetime. That has been crushing and underfunding public education, making it so challenging for school teachers and education workers just to come to work and do their job. And so a lot of the organizing that we did, in my opinion, kind of started around that. But then of course COVID hit, helping students and helping families respond to the COVID challenge and everything that went on with the, you know, the far right and their convoy that they went across the country. So we found ourselves organizing against that. And then, you know, the most horrible thing that I've seen in my own lifetime, and I think a lot of us really understand, I mean, we're school teachers. So when you look at things like the Ontario College of Teachers standards of practice, we have a fiduciary duty to care for students the same way that we would care for our own children. You know, when you look at the, you know, I'm a member of ETFO, the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, and teacher unions have always fought against apartheid and injustice. And so I think it's just natural that there's many, you know, school teachers, because of their conscience, understand that standing up for our Palestinian siblings is just part of what we do as school teachers. That's how I kind of saw the timeline, but I'm not sure what Michelle and Laura might say.
Like the timeline has always been there for a lot of activists. Like we've always been kind of doing this work, I think, and now we're it's almost like for the last 2 years we've merged, like my equity circles kind of merged to try to figure out, you know, this big right-wing thing that's kind of like landed on us, and then anti-Palestinian racism. It came out of the problem in schools and the silencing that teachers feel. And I don't, you know, I've always been in equity work as long as I've been an educator, and it's never been so scary I don't remember ever being so scared to speak truth. I've always talked about political things in my classroom in terms of like social justice. And yeah, the last 2 years have been really intense and like a clamp down on that. So I'm not feeling like I could even be me.
I mean, for me as a Palestinian, this has been my whole life. It certainly did not start on October 7th. And I've kind of been in and out of research and being with my uncle, who's also a scholar. I visited Jerusalem. I visited my grandfather's grave there. So it's been a very personal part of me. But I never talked about it at school. I never felt safe. Even before October 7th, I never talked about being Palestinian. I don't think any of my colleagues ever knew that I was Palestinian, even though my last name is Arabic, but I'm not. But I never talked about it because I'm half Palestinian. I don't look Palestinian. I don't look Arab, but it is part of my heritage and culture. Now, after October 7th, I was so disappointed with the board's response. And again, I felt silenced and I felt I had nowhere to turn and I didn't know who were my allies. I didn't know who I could talk to about this. I never even used the word allies before October 7th. My whole words have changed, like allies and martyrs and genocide has all, you know, come to play. So it's been very stressful, to say the least, and disappointing. Disappointed on so many levels with our government, with my school board, you know, my employer. It's been just a huge disappointment. But there is some rays of light that I think Michelle might talk about with our delegations. The teachers have done videos about divestment for pension. I've sent emails to MPs, the mayor. I use Facebook as a tool to educate people. I think I've probably lost a lot of friends, but I've gained about 3,000 followers. And I use LinkedIn as I just wrote a very short post about my father being Palestinian, and I got over 100,000 views on this post. So it just kind of blew up. So that's encouraging to me. I've had a lot of support on LinkedIn.
One of the big reasons we drew you into the studio was another aspect of the work that you folks have been doing, and that is gathering data and experiences that are happening throughout the boards that you work with for. I'm not sure the correct language there, but you've also, I mean, Sheila just attested to the fact that she's never felt comfortable talking about her Palestinian heritage in that education system. So I guess what I'm looking for is, at what point did you realize there needed to be very specific board work?
In the early days, before we started having any sort of data, what we realized was that there was no data, and that there's this big gap in examples of anti-Palestinian racism. And, you know, it's not in any of the portals, like when schools are reporting incidents of hate. So because there was this gap in data, we tried to fill it up with, because we knew there were stories. We were hearing a lot of stories from teachers, from families, but there was no way of capturing it and no one was capturing it. So it was just this collection of stories and experiences that kind of like lived on their own. And I think everyone kind of, in their own way, found little groups. For me, it was finding like scared teachers, like who has been scared to speak, like come talk to us, and like small little covert groups that go bigger, and like you find out that someone else has experienced something and then we invited them in. And then it was looking at every story to kind of map that on a on a sort of visual to tell people like the larger picture.
And to kind of find out where to intervene, like where there could be some tangible work done, you know, like in your recommendations. A lot of you, we've shared your first names. Nigel, you shared the whole spiel, but not everybody feels comfortable doing this work out in the open, speaking on the record, using, you know, the names that we've shared are not even necessarily your real names. We'll leave people guessing, right? But who would like to speak to why that work, a lot of it is done anonymously, what the atmosphere is like for educators specifically?
We represent members across the Toronto District School Board. We have over 10,000 of them. And what I've observed is that we have an employer that has called members, school teachers and education workers, to what they call opportunity to respond meetings, where basically they're disciplinary meetings for any activity or anything that would remotely look like you are being, you're showing any kind of love towards Palestinian community. And so they call them into these meetings for any anything. And I mean, whether it's like doing a coloring activity or anything at all, you know, that remotely shows any care towards Palestine. And while most of these meetings, the majority of these meetings, end with just, you know, the teacher being cautioned for their behavior, that they, for it not to be anti-Semitism, it really has had a chilling effect. Right. So it really scares teachers. And then it scares teachers who see the actual teacher educator that went through this. You know, I know that I myself have received a notice from B'nai B'rith for libel, for saying things like they were spying on school teachers like Javier Davila, for saying things like they lied about children at Marc Garneau, saying that they were chanting things that were just not, you know, saying that they were accusing them of being anti-Semitic. And even when they were proven wrong, they still didn't walk it back. And so, and then there's, of course, this Friends of Simon Wiesenthal, who by the CBC in December, we saw that they were actually told their staff to spy on and report on children that showed any kind of love or solidarity or just caring for Palestinian children. So, you know, I know in my own personal case, you know, my lawyer wrote back to them and said, look, what we said is absolutely true. If you want to move ahead, go ahead. And we haven't heard back from them. But this is not, you know, it's not about me. This has been happening to thousands of activists across our country, across North America. And what was really telling, just a few weeks ago, the New York Times came out with an article that clearly walked us through that this is a systemic issue, that the Heritage Foundation has been partnering with a number of very large influential political organizations to make sure that they silence any kind of Palestinian solidarity. So this is systemic, and it really is another reason why unions need to start stepping up and protecting free speech. This is a free speech issue. We live in Canada. We have the right to speak and to speak against a foreign state that is breaking international law. That is the Canadian way. So it's, but in what I've observed in the Toronto District School Board is an absolute silencing of teachers whenever they try to show love to Palestinian children. And I get it, but I think that's where, you know, we do have to be principled. We do have to show courage. Anyway, I'm interested in hearing what Sheila and Michelle and Laura might have to say on this.
Like I contacted the human rights department in the board, and because I was concerned for my safety and I wanted support. Like, am I going to get support from my employer if I wear a Palestinian flag pin and a watermelon pin? Like, I can't even believe I have to ask them, but I do, you know. And they said, the lawyer said, yes, of course you can wear that as long as it's not done maliciously.
What does that even mean?
What does that mean?
Yeah,
exactly.
And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that statement alone is like unbelievable. And then he said, also, he warned me, he said, please be careful what you post on social media.
What's that mean?
Exactly. And I didn't listen to him. I don't listen to him. I have actually posted every single day on Facebook. I don't know how many, 800 days now, on Palestine, every single day. I do not know why the board has not gone after me. And the only thing I can think of is I am Palestinian. That's the only thing that's saving me. Otherwise, the board could have, they could have.
You're daring them.
I am. I was really daring them on LinkedIn. I use my full name on LinkedIn. You know, I've had the director of education look at some of my statements that I've made, and I can't believe I haven't been reprimanded. The only thing, it must be because I'm Palestinian. So that would look really bad, wouldn't it? If you're,
it usually doesn't have an advantage, Sheila. Yeah, so I mean, like, soak it up, I guess.
Yeah, that's the only.
But can I ask a clarifying question? You folks both have referred to your employer. That, do you mean the boards or the province?
Toronto District School Board.
The same.
In our case. Sorry, Sheila.
I'm even afraid to say the Toronto District School Board. That's how I'm afraid I am.
I'll say it. It's not only the Toronto District School Board. It's other school boards too. Halton, region, York Region, Durham. And it's, and it, a lot of it comes from Doug Ford, right? Because we saw what Doug Ford, how Doug Ford and his racist commentary towards, you know, Palestinian children. I don't get how, you see, we're school teachers. We know how to love our Israeli, our Jewish, our Palestinian, and our Muslim children. Like, that's what we do every day in our classroom. We have children from every part of the globe. And we bring them into our classroom. We teach them, we give them a sense of belonging. We help them to, like, feel loved and feel safe. That's what we should be getting from our premier. That's what we should be getting from our prime minister. And I think that that's what's missing. And then, of course, there's the orange guy down south.
I just wanted to add that, I mean, I've been involved in activist equity justice work for my whole career for over 20 years. And I feel like on every issue, this is sort of echoing something that Laura said earlier, on every issue, there's been kind of a unity of people who are progressive, who share values, who see things a certain way, you know, whether it's pushing for all gender washrooms or whether it's recognizing diversity. It has felt pretty much like people were all together. And I feel like this is the first time that I have seen that there is a really, that there's a muddying of the waters where it's present, the people with power are presenting this issue as Jews versus Palestinians without recognizing the underlying patriarchy and colonialism that has, and white supremacy that has created these two groups as marginalized groups in the first place. And it has created this rights conflict, this, I'm using air quotes anyway, this idea of a rights conflict, which is that anything that advances one group automatically disadvantages the other group. Consequently, people are really, really afraid of being smeared as anti-Semitic. So there's this concern that if you speak out about Palestinian rights or about genocide or Gaza, that you are inherently being critical of Jews and being anti-Semitic. And this is not an accident. This conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism or anti-Israel sentiments has been manufactured. And so now, if as a school teacher, I have a student who wants to talk about their experience in the Nakba, I feel like, oh, wait a minute, you can't say that. That's anti-Semitic, which is false. As Nigel said, criticism of a country is fine. Our Ontario Human Rights Code is extremely clear that that is not, it's not problematic unless I say all Jews are represented by this state and this state is doing bad things. That's not okay. But if I'm saying I disagree with the policies of this country or that country, that's not anti-Semitic. And I think the main problem is because this conflation has been so effective, people don't know what is okay to say and what is not okay to say. So that's why, in response to your original question, why are people scared? People are scared because they are worried that if they say something, they will be portrayed as anti-Semitic. And that's like the worst, whatever. Anyway, thank you.
On that point, I have been called anti-Semitic, and it's almost meaningless now. Like I find it's being used so often that to me, the impact of it, the gravitas of it is not there anymore.
For me personally, it's been hard because, you know, when I talk to other people who I've been organizing with, we worry about, you know, a lot of us have been quietly doing a lot of equity work, not just around Palestinian racism, but around Black racism, affirming Muslim identities, like a whole lot of other stuff that we're worried that, you know, if someone tries to stop my work, or if someone tells me, or if someone accuses me of being anti-Semitic, I could be sacrificing the other work that I'm doing. Like, it could really impact the groups that I'm in. It could bring attention to others, and I have to be so careful of that. It feels like it's higher stakes. And for someone like me, like, I'm super sensitive. So if someone is telling me, you're not making me feel safe, like, I start doubting myself, right? If there's parents, if there's certain groups of people saying, like, I no longer feel safe at school, like, that really, like, that scares me. That makes me worried. Like, I'm worried that I'm doing the wrong thing, or that I'm hurting someone's feelings. And then all of those things just make it, like Michelle said, like, there's all these conflations that are happening, and then so many layers.
On top of the equity work, I mean, your teachers, Nigel just explained how the passion behind teaching, and that I think most people think of when they think of teachers. And we've seen teachers removed from their positions, whether it be temporary or not, right? Like, actual, not just called into a meeting, but taken from the work that they love, just as you described. I wonder, the conflation, I think the audience understands, right? We've talked a lot about why it's not anti-Semitic to support a free Palestine. But some of the examples that you give, the delegations that were collected and analyzed and categorized, some of them were kind of not expected. I mean, in this atmosphere and who we're talking to, the audience is likely going to expect that. But you talked about the isolation, and alienation is another category that you folks use. To me, that was a little less obvious. Can you explain the examples that you're finding within the boards where, you know, just for the audience, maybe they're not going to read the report. You should. But, you know, folks are told they can't wear Palestinian colors or pins, or their work is extra scrutinized. You know, one example was, I think, some sort of art presentation, and they like needed to get everything approved only because it was talking about Palestine. So like the silencing, we can see reprisals, you've talked about weaponizing anti-Semitism. But again, going back to what does the alienation and the isolation look like in this respect?
Well, for me, it's the silence. I called it the silence in the hallways. Like, I didn't see any bake sales for Palestine in the schools. But, you know, previous years, I saw lots of bake sales for Ukraine. I saw the Ukraine flag being flown in front of one of the schools I was at. And but when it comes to Palestine, there's nothing, at least in the schools that I've been at. And some people call me brave, and I always say to myself, well, I trick my brain into thinking I'm from Ukraine. And if they can speak up, then I can speak up. Like, there should be no reason why I can't speak up because I'm Palestinian. So I just pretend that the world accepts me, and then that's how I speak up and use my voice as much as I can.
That's really sad.
I know.
That's very sad, and that reminds me of like story, you know, I've heard from when we were analyzing the data, the alienation, the way we kind of we looked at all of the incidents, and then we put them into these categories. And sometimes incidents went across several categories. And in that situation, we checked every category. So when you, so the alienation isolation is often part of like other things that are happening, including the silencing. But that reminds, like, I've had a Palestinian teacher and Palestinian families just say, like, they don't feel seen. They don't feel like there's, they don't see anything in the classroom or in the school that reflects them. And it really gives them, like, Palestinian teachers and families and students, like, the sense that we don't care. The first time I met with Toronto Palestinian families, I was bawling because the stories are so sad. And you realize, like, I'm a teacher in one of your kids' schools. Like, your kids are my kids. I can't believe that they feel so alone and isolated that they don't have a teacher even that they feel safe talking to about what's going on.
So in this atmosphere that you're all describing, you are challenging the boards to do better, right? You're presenting this to them. Some of you have described being delegates at and speaking to the boards. How is it going? What has the response been like? Because I imagine, well, not that I'm letting anybody off the hook, but the same pressures and alienation and, you know, reprisals don't just exist for teachers, right? But some trustees are likely feeling it and decision makers. How are they responding when you are kind of doubly presenting these delegations? Because they sat through many of these delegations, not in other boards, right? But they were subjected to these experiences that they surely know aren't unique. And they didn't really respond all that well. You folks list a couple of boards that responded in better ways than others, but largely that was Hamilton Wentworth and it was student trustee driven. Shout out to the students. But otherwise, what has the mood been like from the board and the response when you press them further with this?
Primarily, my engagement with the board has been in two ways. One is I'm a member of Toronto Jewish Families, which is in coalition with Toronto Palestinian Families, which we're together on your show previously. And we formed quite a few years ago, prior to October 7th. And we were concerned about these issues of erasure of Palestinian voice and identity in the board. And I don't remember the exact dates, but we did request a meeting with the executive superintendents, and we met with them, and people were very receptive, and, you know, they said all kinds of nice things, but then there was no action taken. So they listened, they gave us time, we had a Zoom, they listened and seemed to want to work with us, but then it didn't go anywhere. There was no change in policy. There was no response. We tried to engage further and there was nothing. So that was very frustrating. And there have been some kinds of ongoing engagements over time, but nothing has really led to any concrete changes. That being said, I want to just point out some significant successes that have occurred as a result of this basically silencing, or I don't know, consulting to death or whatever you call it, that, you know, they would listen, but then not do anything. We have been, members of our group, of our broader coalition, have been presenting delegations to board meetings on various topics over the last couple of years when we felt like there was an opportunity to use our personal stories or our positions to push the board on these issues. And mainly our concern was that what the board was doing was in conflict with their own stated human rights policies or their own stated equity policies. And one was last June 2024, as a response to delegations, the board did agree to add anti-Palestinian racism to its equity policy. The Toronto District School Board agreed to add anti-Palestinian racism as a concern and as something that would be covered by its anti-hate, anti-racism strategy. So that was a big success. Again, though, it was on paper. We didn't see any actual action taken. But that was, I think, a good first step. And then more recently, in fact, just this past week, there was also another big success. There was an event that took place last fall with Grassy Narrows to advocate for clean water for the Grassy Narrows community. Some people who are making connections between Palestine and anti-Indigenous racism in Canada and Turtle Island. And after that, there was an investigation requested by parents who were upset that their children might have seen some Palestinian solidarity. And the result of the report was that there was a human rights level of erasure happening at the Toronto District School Board.
Not the result they wanted from those claims, eh?
In fact, it was the opposite, because the people who wanted the report wanted their finding to say, no, this was harmful for our students to be exposed to the Palestinian solidarity. Anyway, one of the recommendations of this report was that the Toronto District School Board executive team should receive training in anti-Palestinian racism and anti-Semitism, and that should be developed by the ministry and delivered to the board. That was developed, and in fact, the inspector said, yeah, but sometimes trainings are requested and then nothing happens. But then the follow-up, which was really great, was one of the trustees, Alexis Dawson, put forward a motion to say, we clearly have a problem of anti-Palestinian racism in the Toronto District School Board, and we request that the ministry develop and deliver these trainings as per this inspector's report, or investigator's report, sorry. And so that was huge. And it was based, and the proof that she used to say, look, we have anti-Palestinian racism in the board, was all of these delegations that have happened over the last year and a half, where parents and teachers and students have been saying, this is my experience, this is what has happened to me. And it was just, you know, we're like, is anyone listening? Is anyone paying attention? And the fact that not only did this motion pass, but it passed strongly, 15-5, trustees voted in favor. And that's really a testament to all those people who have delegated and the hard work that Alexis put in working with fellow trustees to see, this is a problem, and look, here's a proposed solution. We need to follow up on this. So I think that was really a huge success.
It also speaks to the power of delegations, because I know there's a lot of people out there very, very frustrated, not even just when we're talking about this particular issue where you have listed so many delegations and then almost a complete lack of response from the people listening to them. And we've seen this in Toronto City Council. The bubble zone laws are the most recent example, where it's just overwhelming evidence to spur politicians to do the right thing. But we're seeing organizations like yourself having to do that whole extra legwork, but adding more value to these delegations, getting them more airtime, more exposure, and gathering them as the necessary documents, evidence, right? So that for all sorts of reasons, you've given many examples now of how these delegations have been used, because there's not a lot of avenues for people to be heard, right? These situations, board meetings, council meetings, regional meetings, are the very few opportunities where the public can be on record, right? Like, I don't think you would have been able to gather testimonials and carry the same weight as if they were kind of public delegations. How do you still do a lot of work in generating delegations? And are you finding it easier to convince people, not just of its value to, like, because some people are nervous, right? You're asking them to share their personal experience publicly, front facing, vulnerable, but also under this atmosphere that you've described that exists outside the school board too, right? Folks like B'nai B'rith are not just watching teachers, right? But they are watching these delegations and taking notes and doxing people and whatnot. So is that work in delegating and getting people to take their story forward, is that becoming easier to do? Are we making space for that?
I think we do make space for that. I think every time there's a board meeting, there's a, you know, there's a group of us that are like, okay, delegations are happening, and we try to rally people. There's a lot of people who are, I think every time there might be like a few new people, and there's a lot of people that are just like, I've never done this before. How do I do this? It's been like helping people fill forms, reading through delegations, and like offering that support, making sure people aren't going alone. It's quite organized. And I think TPF and TJF have like really gotten the community to come out and like have made it easy and accessible for community to participate and empowering the community, that they have a voice and that they could use it. You know, when we were analyzing the delegations, and I don't know if anyone here realizes this, but when we were analyzing the delegations, we only analyzed our own delegations. We analyzed ally delegations. We didn't analyze the other side's delegations. So what you're seeing are like an underreported amount of all of these, you know, erasure and silencing. Like those are firsthand accounts. You know, if we did this again, like if we included all of the delegations, like, because some of the antagonistic delegations have definitely, you know, been very, very harmful to families and to people who are kind of like listening. And they definitely have examples of erasure, alienation, racism in them.
I can understand why you wouldn't want to regurgitate some of the delegations that.
Yeah.
We're just, yeah, perpetuating the same anti-Palestinian racism that you're trying, although they do provide evidence, like, you see, do you see what our students are hearing? Do you see what our teachers are exposed to? Palestinian families have to, like, listen to them. But, yeah, there's voices that we really need to lift up. They get enough of a platform already. And I want to talk about that, too, Michelle. Because the muddying of the waters, like you say, is in part it's strictly anti-Palestinian racism, and that has all kinds of roots and purposes that we can get into. But a lot of it is just strictly driven by this ill-defined anti-Semitism. Not even ill-defined is not the right way to describe it, where it's been weaponized. That's the words that you folks use in the report, and justly so. That must be extremely frustrating for somebody who has already been doing work in trying to combat anti-Semitism. And then, you know, no shade to Sheila, because we know exactly, I saw you nodding, you knew exactly what she meant when she's like, when people call me anti-Semitic, it almost means nothing anymore. That is incredibly frustrating, I imagine, but there are reasons why these attitudes are permeating throughout the school boards, not just, you know, the same thing we're all experiencing, you know, the media and whatnot. But there are organizations that have teamed up with the board that perpetuate this problem, right? So they're almost working directly against your work. But they are given a lot more credentials or credence, rather, when it comes to speaking to the board and dealing with the Ministry of Education, right? Like you folks have to really wave your hands and do all kinds of work and like listen to us, but these folks have kind of easy access to decision makers. What's it been like trying to undo some of that at the board level?
Well, one of our platforms in Toronto Jewish Families is to end partnerships with harmful organizations. So that's definitely been something that we've been working on. I think you're totally right that there are these large, well-funded organizations that, and I think one of the most dangerous things about these organizations is that they claim to represent all Jews. And then they can say, oh yes, all Jews believe this and all Jews believe that. And then that's obviously erasing the identities of Jews who are critical of their work, but also having all of these other harmful consequences. So that is definitely something that we've been working on. And the results in the Toronto District School Board is that the board said that they're coming up with a process to reevaluate their partnerships, but that was over a year ago. So I'm not sure where that stands. And they seem to continue to work in alliance with, between the board and some of these organizations.
And some of these organizations are funded by the Ontario government, by the provincial government, at the tune of $150,000. I was quite shocked to learn that. So they have a lot of money and power behind them.
That's right. They just recently increased the funding to some of these organizations, right? It wasn't all that long ago that they dedicated more funds in trying to target anti-Semitism. There's a part in your report where it acknowledges that this is a provincial responsibility, but a lot of the work that you're doing is clearly at the board level. I mean, they're your employers. I get that. Are we expecting the province to do anything as well? Are you working there? I know you mentioned that the TDSB has now like officially put in a request for the ministry to, you know, define and come up with a program of sorts for anti-Palestinian racism training. Have they responded?
I mean, I think the process is slow, even at the board level. Like, when anti-Palestinian racism was put on the anti-hate strategy, it had like a timeline of like 2025, 2026. And we're talking like next school year, and things keep on getting pushed back and consultations get pushed back. And it's like this constant putting pressure on the board of like when, and then having, you know, every little win gets kind of antagonized afterwards. Like the Grassy Narrows investigation was, you know, publicized as like, that's not the right answer. But I think there's a lot of power, and maybe Nigel could speak to this, like in labor movements, right? I think a lot of work can be done through our unions, and that's like another avenue of trying to get to that unity.
Laura, I mean, I agree with you that it's the responsibility actually of trade unions and certainly of school teacher unions and education unions to be fighting for in support of international law. I think, you know, we right now, even within our own union or this union, we're having a struggle, right? Like to for that identity. While I know that there are many activists and many school teachers who like are, you know, don't agree with the genocide that we see happening right in real time, they have been terrified to say anything out loud. But yet we have other school teachers who are denying this genocide that is happening. And it seems that their voices are the ones that are so loud and that people are more afraid of. So it really is going to, like, we're at a watershed moment in our country, you know, and I think our union is reflective of the general society, right? Where are people going to land? And, you know, your heart knows that it's wrong. And that we as school teachers, we can love all children, regardless of what their background is. But I don't know, like, as I stand here with you in this meeting right at this moment, I am extremely concerned whether or not we'll have the majority of our members that are going to have the courage to stand on the right side of history. It is a story that's being written.
Well, I just thinking about, I've seen Nigel being personally attacked on Facebook, right, Nigel? Like during some of the discussions, by one particular teacher has messaged him over 100 times. And then I stepped in and supported Nigel. And I think I made a difference in that conversation. I was scared, but I couldn't just let that happen. So yeah,
it was very brave of you, and thank you.
Glad.
In response also to the question about the provincial level, I think we've seen several courageous MPPs take a stand on this issue, and they had consequences for their solidarity. And I think the same challenges that we face in our board are a microcosm of what is happening provincially and also obviously beyond, that people in leadership positions at the provincial level are worried about being smeared as anti-Semitic as well.
I'm slightly frustrated at hearing unionized workers having to do all of this kind of unofficially. We say, like, Labor for Palestine, for folks who didn't hear that episode, I will link that as well as with the Toronto families, Jewish and Palestinian families. But it's more rank and file. Like, it's not, you use a big L, but as when it comes to union leadership or the official positions of the education unions, other unions are, you know, having the same issues, but we're here talking about education right now. There doesn't seem to be a lot of leadership when it comes to this. And same microcosm. We saw Fred Hahn get completely blasted and isolated, and everyone knows I will link the episode on that as well in case people are like, what are you talking about? I don't know, maybe they're from Saskatchewan or something, but they don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, I think they can imagine that the same, but I think we expect more of the folks that are voted to lead, right? So I can understand a teacher, especially if they don't feel like they're being backed up. When it comes to dealing with the boards, are you folks feeling supported by your union?
That's so tricky.
Yeah, I bet.
My union is open to learning about my background and history, which I appreciate, but I don't really see any action, to be honest.
And for me, like, I see Nigel, seeing Nigel helps me be more brave. And I'm lucky that he has this position that I'm like, yes, my friend is saying this. I feel okay saying this too. But I do wish it was, like, not just Nigel and it was, like, all of ETT saying it, so that it was, like, I would feel more protected. But I also know, like, from the other side, is that there's also the other side asking Nigel to protect them. Like, there's, like, you know, the union has to protect everybody. And, like, because they have to protect everybody, it makes me a little worried, right? It makes me mad sometimes. I'm like, why do you guys have to protect racists? Like, I don't understand. Like, can't we just fire them? And that's where I think union stuff gets sticky. I don't know.
I made a human rights complaint against a fellow teacher. But it was an online racist comment she made to me. But my union was just they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know how to handle it. I'm in a different union than Nigel and Laura. I'm in the occasional teachers union, elementary occasional teachers union. And my union reps didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to do with it. But I did fill out a human rights complaint form, but nothing's happened. Nothing has come to it.
Not because they don't know how to handle a human rights complaint, but because of the muddied water.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I do feel fortunate, Nigel. Like, people have told me, like, oh, you're so lucky you're ETT. You got Nigel. Like, you have, like, these strong voices. So I am thankful for that. Like, I could be in a way less protected spot.
I mean, don't forget, unions are, we're a democratic organization. So union leaders are making a calculation, no different from what these MPs and MPPs make, right? And so the easiest thing for a union leader to do is to, like, not say anything at all.
You're not.
Right? And then, well, I mean, I think there are leaders. I mean, there are people in these positions. They know that they have to take a principled position, right? I mean, that's what it really comes down to. And I think, you know, those are the kind of people that I want to see leading our country. Those are the kind of people that I would love to see leading our school board. Those are the kind of people that I want to see at the front of our classrooms, right? People that are grounded in social injustice for all people, not just for a few.
I just wanted to add too that I think that there are different levels of our union leadership, right? So our union local Elementary Teachers of Toronto, I think, has done an exceptional job of supporting teachers in all kinds of circumstances. And I know that when I've had a few situations where I was targeted online or things have been a little difficult, and I know, and I've had direct support from Nigel, from Elementary Teachers of Toronto, and I did feel absolutely supported. That being said, I think there are larger provincial union at Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario has not been vocal on this. And in fact, I've been doing some work in developing some resources for them on anti-Semitism. And I understand that their position is that they need to be careful because at the end of the day, they don't want to put teachers in a situation where they might be at risk from their respective employers. And so they have to kind of follow the lead of the boards, whereas I think the Elementary Teachers of Toronto has taken on that leadership position. So I think it depends on the level that we're talking.
No wonder that answer was tricky. I forgot Nigel. I forgot Nigel was here.
That's okay.
No, but everyone answered that so not diplomatically, but
yeah,
you know,
your
experience is not that of, you know, everybody in the various school boards across. How many school boards do we have in Ontario? You must know.
I think there's like 81 or
what?
There's a lot of them.
That's so much work because I'm thinking, you know, some of these trustees, we got to replace them. You need motions that are obviously brought forward, and it's not good enough to just have some trustees that are like willing to take a meeting with you and listen with a sympathetic ear and maybe give a donation anonymously, or, you know, maybe locals are doing that too. It's like we need folks up there that are going to be so vocal and have got, you know, nothing to lose in that regard, or don't, you know, they understand that it's worth it. Do you ever talk about intervening in these elections? I mean, not manipulation, but just encouraging more folks to look at school board elections, trustee elections that happen at the same time as our municipal elections, in case people don't know, because it's not much we talk about, right? We want to know who the mayor is going to be, maybe councillor. I mean, in the rural area, nobody even votes for that. It's like really low engagement. But wow, the impact of who sits on those boards is immense, right? Especially when you can't trust the ministry to do anything, or you at least need advocates against the ministry, which you shouldn't, but let's be real, right? So is that ever part of your discussion? Or
I mean, no, it's not. I mean, we go through an endorsement process at all, you know, for our local, like our, it's MPPs and trustees that are the main kind of decision makers. So we actually actively try to support what we feel are progressive trustees and MPPs. There has been a complete trend from the right to run candidates that are supportive of a hard right wing agenda, both fiscally and socially conservative, and so you're seeing that happen in many school boards, and it's something that, like I said, I mean, it is part of the whole thing that's happening with this hard shift that we see in the right. Is, you know, like where fascism is something that's actually real, like it could happen tomorrow. Like we just missed it here in Canada. Like I'm raising a nine-year-old, and I can't believe that I'm so terrified about the world that he's going to inhabit, because, you know, like we're seeing fascism in real time happening around the globe.
Yeah, we did see the right mobilize around the boards a little bit stronger and sooner than I think the broader kind of public understood the value of that move, or the long-term implications. Perhaps they didn't give a shit about trans kids in school, you know, enough to mobilize against that issue. But it's just one thing after another where people are coming in here and explaining, you know, the impacts that school boards have in Ontario. I know it's not the same in every province. So, but is there anything you folks would like to share about either the report process or your own experience before we sign off.
As a Jewish educator in the Toronto District School Board, I'm a member of the Jewish Heritage Committee, which purports to represent Jewish staff broadly. And I guess this was a response to your question about the, you know, the isolation or how we feel responded to by the board. So I just wanted to raise this concern, which is that really the Jewish Heritage Committee should be a represent Jewish staff in their diversity. And unfortunately, what we continue to see is that the Jewish Heritage Committee represents Jewish staff as being monolithic, as holding one position on Israel, and it's very frustrating as a Jewish educator to see this group so harmfully misrepresent me and my perspective. And I think the effect is that it makes many people feel unsafe, because, you know, there have been posts online about solidarity with Israel and on behalf of the Jewish Heritage Committee, and it feels very frustrating. I think the union is one of the ways that our voice is represented, but the Heritage Committees are another. And so to feel so ignored and silenced by our Jewish Heritage Committee is just an example of the lack of acknowledgement of diversity within, at least within that portion of the Toronto District School Board.
Because the delegations were quite diverse. And you reported that, of those who identified what their, you know, religion or culture was there, there was an equal number of people who identified as Palestinian as there was Jewish speaking to anti-Palestinian racism.
Yes, there are many Jewish opinions on both sides or on multiple sides, and the perspective of the Jewish Heritage Committee and the Jewish representation in the higher levels of the board is that we are fringe minority, which we've heard in many different contexts, but that our position is ignorable because there are so few of us. So it's it's truly ironic that we are represented in the delegation not as a fringe minority, but that's how we're characterized.
Something that I've been struggling with is the fact that the board doesn't recognize the Nakba Day, and I just feel like it's the least they could do. They at least give us one day. One day. They have all these other special interest days. They have, you know, the Greek month, they have Black History Month. Like, can they not just give us one day? And I know I called the equity department and they said there's a moratorium on special days. And I just feel we're always, you know, I feel like we're always coming against a brick wall. And I hope that in the near future that we can have the one day, the Nakba Day. And a friend of mine is a social worker at a school, at a middle school. And she asked the principal if she could talk about Nakba Day, and the principal said, no, I'm not going to allow you to talk about it. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting. Well, isn't the board pride themselves on inclusion? But, you know, I guess it's inclusion for some and not for everyone.
They're so bold when it comes to that kind of exclusion, right? Like, usually people try to couch their racism or their discrimination in, like, bureaucratic things, you know, like no new holidays. So come on, give me that, right? Other than just being like, nope, sorry, you can't talk about that. We reserve the right to talk about one genocide and one genocide only. How enraging too in Toronto for them to mark Israeli Independence Day rather than Nakba Day. The battles we have in front of us. But Laura and Nigel, any parting gifts of wisdom or things you didn't get to say while we were talking?
For me, it's the Martin Luther King's quote around, you know, my emancipation is connected to your emancipation. Like, you know, none of us are free until we're all free. I think it's, you know, My activism is important to me because it's about humanity and about human beings. So there's nothing special. It's just about being a human being. And I'm really grateful to have been able to share space with all of you here today. And just this great program, really, thank you very much. There's not a lot of places where voices like ours can be heard and feel comfortable and be respected like this. So thank you so much.
Oh, I mean, the feeling's mutual when you folks come on here and talk about the work that you do and the risks that y'all take. And it's, you don't just uplift me, I'm privy to it, but you know, there's folks listening that each get a little bit more courageous, just the way Laura described watching you work, Nigel. So the impact, if I can just amplify some of this a little bit, then that's like the least I feel like I can do sometimes, right? To make me feel like I'm doing my job, my role in all of this. But Laura, you get last laugh or not, you know?
You know, what's been surprising for me, the most surprising for me, disappointingly, is that we've heard this, the Palestinian issue being the litmus test of our time kind of thing, and it's so real. Like, I wish it wasn't, it sounds so kind of like cliche now, I'm like, but it's so, like, I'm surprised at how many people I've lost as allies, right? People who I really thought, same equity mind as me, we've been working on these same projects, but on this one issue, like, we're not on the same page. And I think that tells me a lot about how serious people are about, you know, anti-racism and social justice. And yeah, like Sheila said, like, for everyone I've lost, I've gained a lot of people. There's been so much community. And I think that's what carries us through. Like, I can lose those people. Like, I've realized that. I'm like, I can lose people. I'm like, and the people I find in doing this work and following my conscience, I know is right, and there's no regrets.
No. It's like we all collectively went through this moment where, you know, sometimes it's on an individual level, something horrible happens to you, and it's like whoever's there for you in those moments are your real friends. It's like so many of us went through, I know it didn't start on October 7th, but that day changed everything. Like, even people who had been willing to talk about Palestine lost a lot of courage. But then we saw people who had never paid attention before. Like, and those people have been multiplied far greater than the comrades, so-called comrades that we had filtered, that were filtered for us.
Can I just add one last thing just to echo what Nigel had said earlier, just that I think what we're missing here by pitting people against each other is that at the very bottom, we are teaching children, and it is our duty to see the humanity in every student that comes into our class. And if we're saying this child is more valuable or more worthwhile or whatever, that then we're losing, that we've lost the thread. But really, at the end of the day, how can we uplift the humanity of every child that walks into our class and allow them to fully be their own full self? That's our role. That's what we're hired for. And if we're not doing that, then I think we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Beautifully said.
Well, I mean, I think you folks are doing what you're supposed to be doing. So I very much appreciate that. Labor for Palestine, education workers, you folks have been on the front lines more than once. We are often looking to education workers to fix a lot of our problems, don't we? That's because you've got the future in your hands. It's not my fault. A lot of pressure on you folks to do the right thing. And I'm very glad a lot of you have answered the call. I know that you're not representative of the whole. You have so many more comrades that we couldn't fit into the studio. but it's good to see that work is being done and you're making progress, right? Even if it's baby steps. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for this opportunity.
Yes.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us.